Welcome everybody to the CIFC National Fire Management Conversation for this month. Today we've got with us Josh Johnston, who's going to be talking about Wildfire SAT project. So for those who aren't aware, Wildfire SAT is the first purpose-built wildfire satellite in the world. And Josh has been the primary investigator on this project since its inception in 2018. He is a forest fire research scientist with the CFS in Sault Ste. Marie, and he's going to tell us all about Wildfire SAT. So feel free to take it away, Josh.
Right on. Thank you, sir. I like that intro. That was nice and casual. It's just the way I like it. Well, thanks a lot for tuning in today, folks. I'm going to walk you through everything. Well, not everything. There's an awful lot that folks aren't going to want to know, but I'm going to give you the high level coverage of what the mission's all about and kind of where we're at and where we're going. If you have heard me talk about this before, I apologize to you for that. But the reality is that things have changed since I last spoke with CIFC here. Most importantly, the mission itself has become an operational mission. Historically, or if you've heard me talk probably around this time last year, we were kind of in a position of pathfinding. We had some funding to do something, but it wasn't quite enough. And we weren't really sure what the trajectory of things was going to be. And then we received clarity in that trajectory in April when the budget came out and topped up our funding and turned it into a fully operational mission, which, you know, is it's a wonderful thing. It's one of those things where when it happens, it redefines your personal priorities in a very, very, very concise way. So without further ado, let's get into this and we'll talk a little bit about what it's all about and what's up. So, you know, when Matt introduced, he said, you know, I've been the PI of this mission since its inception as Wildfire SAT in 2018. The mission itself goes way back, and I've been involved in it since the beginning. But before we even talk about why we're doing this, I just want to make it clear, the first paper that came out saying that we can monitor wildfires, active fires from satellites operationally, that first paper was in 1986. And it's been a long time coming. I can remember in the late 80s, my father, who was another fire manager, you know, just being super pumped that satellites were going to change the way they do business. And I think many of you have probably heard the promise here and there and watched it fizzle to virtually nothing, or certainly nothing transformative. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think the most important one and the big difference, what's enabled Wildfire SAT where there's been barriers before, it has to do with technology. Previously, when you would build a system to monitor fires from a satellite, you know, it always depends on infrared. And that typically means that you have to use a cooling system. And a cooling system for the detector would require a lot of power, like a crazy amount of power. And on a small satellite, that would mean that in order to make it feasible to use it, you'd need to build the system like a satellite that was the size of a truck, sometimes the size of one of those small school buses even. And that's not cheap. Costs you a lot of money to put anything into space, and it's really based on mass. So the bigger it is, the more expensive it is. And all of those missions had always had to be multi-purpose. They had to be built to serve a variety of users. And if you build something to support a variety of users, it means that it's pretty good for a lot of things and it's not perfect for anything. There's a ton of compromise in there. And unfortunately, where the compromises fell for fire, it meant that we could make a lot of really cool stuff, that we could do a lot of really good science with it. We could mature that science in unbelievable ways. But really pushing it into the realm of monitoring fire operationally in support of fire management, that was quite challenging. So the shift, why we are actually here, why we started doing WildFireSat, there was this technology that emerged out of Canadian industry where the right spectral bands that we wanted to use were able to operate without a cooling system. And so whereas you used to needed like basically AC power and a big old bus to run this thing, then all of a sudden you needed a detector that required 4 watts of energy, like about as much as one of your little LED Christmas light bulbs. And that's a game changer. And so we've been nurturing this since about 2010. We pushed it through a phase zero called the Canadian Wildland Fire Monitoring System, CWFMS, showed it was feasible. Then we needed to figure out where we were going to go on that feasibility. We had a whole bunch of different options, the different tech demos that we were considering. CSA put some money towards it in 2018, and we created WildFireSat. We've already gone through phase A of WildFireSat. We have two very strong potential designs or system requirements that would allow us to build a mission. And then we got clarity on the cost envelope for that. And that kind of stalled us out and until the budget announcement. So the long and short of it is, it's a homegrown situation here. It's homegrown technology. The science comes out of Canada, the tech comes out of Canada, and the need comes out of Canada, as you're going to see in a moment. So what's the premise? Well, I don't want to alarm you, but the premise is not detection. And the premise is really a unique thing about Canada. First off, you know, it wasn't that many years ago. I sit on a lot of international committees that, you know, for fire monitoring. It wasn't long ago that I was sitting there watching a lot of people pat themselves on the back and really celebrating because they had everything they ever wanted. They had closed this dome around the earth of these geostationary satellites that were allowing them to persistently monitor fire. Now, the issue is that those are the weather satellites. They're things like GOES and Himawari and MSG Saviri over Africa. They have really good resolution at the equator. And the further north you get, everything starts to smear. You start to lose your geolocation. You have to start seeing through deeper and deeper columns of atmosphere. And as a result, it just doesn't work. Like, you can find fires up here, but you can't do radiometry of them. You can't measure them in a meaningful way, and you can't export products from them into an operational space that would have any sort of value. You know, if your margin of error on the location is 10 kilometers, it may be a problem. So there was a unique issue that we had in the high latitudes. It's an issue we only really share with Russia. And so more or less, this was a situation where we had to figure out our own solution. Now, the other thing that I want, you know, I hinted before, it's not about detection. And that's not to say WildFireSat won't be able to detect fires. It will. But it won't be able to detect fires any better than something like VIRS or MODIS. And I say that as in remote areas, if it's a part of the country where you're not actively looking for a fire, we'll find it first. If it's somewhere where you are engaging in formal detection activities, you will find it first. And so we're not hanging our hat on this is all about detection. What we're really more interested in is, you know, is it possible for us to provide you with a surveillance capability? The ability to monitor fires on a landscape, to track their growth and see what's happening from day to day. And so really that is the outcome that we're seeking here. There's two primary outcomes that lead to a third. First off, we want to provide unprecedented strategic intelligence from satellite systems. And, you know, and in near real time. The second goal kind of extends from that. If you're providing proper assessments, proper measurements of wildfires, it shouldn't be too hard for us to extend that into our smoke modeling domain. And in fact, that's why Environment Canada is one of the departments who partners in this mission. They're a consumer of our products, and that's the intent. And then, you know, tangentially, if you're producing strategic intel and improved air quality and smoke monitoring, and you're doing it in a meaningful way, and it is being uptaked into operations in a meaningful way, then we should be able to provide the information needed to help reduce some of the losses associated with fire. There's a lot of caveats to that. We're going to get into the knowledge exchange work and why that's a priority later. But first thing I want to stress with everyone, WildFireSat is not about providing pretty pictures and imagery. This is an image from Landsat at the bottom. And although that is, you know, the sort of thing that you can throw on your Twitter feed and raise some eyebrows, what we're actually trying to provide is information. And so, you know, the entire program is not about a satellite. It's about a satellite. It's about the midstream where the pipelines that we move data. It's about the information systems and all the scientific products that actually generate tools at the end. And then there's also about this other side of it, the knowledge exchange piece, where we work with the provinces and territories to make sure that we are meeting the needs and that we're designing it to their requirement. How's it going to work? Whole lot of fancy talk. So what's the plan? Why? What are we going to do now that we can build the satellite for our own purposes? Well, as I pointed out before, we can't really rely on geostationary satellites up here. So we rely on polar orbiters, or LEOs, low Earth orbiters. These satellites, they move across the North Pole and the South Pole. And they go, woo. And Earth is turning with them. And as a result, those satellites are kind of time locked. They overpass, no matter where they overpass on the Earth, it's always the same time of day. Which is kind of like a strange sort of purgatory now that I think about it. Poor satellite. But, the cool thing about them is if they have proper coverage, you should get a 12-hour return interval. Once in the morning, once in the evening on the other side of the Earth. That's what we actually depend on right now. Things like MODIS, things like VIRS, those are polar orbiting satellites. The problem is because they have so many compromises built into them, they don't have the overpass times that we would really want. They tend to be all piled up late morning or right around noon. And this is one of the few times, because normally I present this to a lot of people who aren't fire people. I don't need to explain to you the diurnal cycle of fires, but the peak burn period is completely unwatched. It's absolutely unwatched. You catch the very, very first sort of acceleration with VIRS in the early afternoon. Because we don't have a polar orbiter somewhere in peak burn, and because we can't really measure energetics from a geostationary satellite of a fire, at least, I would argue that we've never actually observed the full intensity of a Canadian wildfire. And that's its own pickle that needs to be addressed. So obviously, you've probably guessed, WildFireSat's going to get placed right into that peak burn period, somewhere around 1800. The data sort of look and feel will be nearly identical to VIRS, a few key variances, but very, very similar. And it sits just offset of it so that there's a large portion of the peak burn period between VIRS and WildFireSat. And then sympathetically, we pick up a 6 a.m. overpass as well, which is handy. But I don't want it. Don't confuse yourself into thinking that this is a gap filling mission. It is, but it's more than that. In the world of fire monitoring, or the world of satellites, this is what we would call a virtual constellation. We have designed a system to work with another system that's operated by a different agency, and it's quite specifically VIIRS. Our data doesn't just look similar. Our data will be nearly identical, and it's strategically offset so that, you know, if you're familiar with some of these other products, like day of burn type stuff, where you track a fire on the landscape over the course of its life, days, weeks, or whatever, and you might only get one observation a day. What we're trying to do is give you a full suite of fire characterization at 1 o'clock, then again at 1800, and that gives you the ability to make an assessment of where is that fire headed, how fast is it moving, yada, yada. We'll get to that in a moment. And then, you know, you produce the product shortly afterwards. When I have some decision points thrown on to this timeline, but in general terms, if you broad brush, there tends to be an end of day decision-making cycle for early strategic planning for the next burn period. Our target is to get the products in hand before that period occurs. And then because we do this every 12 hours, you should actually be able to get a full secondary report from WildFireSat at 6 a.m., which would allow you to reassess if anything has changed overnight. Shouldn't change overnight, but you know how it is. They doesn't always play by the rules these days. So this is just slightly more detailed on those specifications. It's, you know, the visible near infrared is about 200 meter resolution. It'll likely be a bit below that, to be honest with you. The midwave and long wave should be locked in nearly 400 meters across swath. So if you're familiar with any of these other systems, because they look straight down, but they have a very wide field of view, when they say, oh, you know, the VIIRS I-band is 370 meters, yes, at nadir. But the further off nadir you go, those pixels keep getting bigger and bigger. In fact, with MODIS, we always say MODIS is 1 kilometer, but edge of swath, it's like 4. In the case of WildFireSat, the variance across swath will be minimal, like less than 5%. I think it might be 2%. I can't quite recall. But what it is we've designed it in such a way that it has to look straight down. And that helps reduce a lot of artifacts. It helps reduce, you know, those non-uniformities across swath, makes your performance consistent across the swath. It causes problems as well. You can't do it from a single satellite. It's a convoy of multiple ones. But just to say that if you do it in that way, and by stripping out the potential for artifacts, by helping to get much, much more consistent data out of the thing, it puts you in a position where you can produce the products super, super fast, and the likelihood that they're going to have something wrong in them is quite a bit reduced, which is our goal. Just kind of high level, I've talked about WildFireSat as its own, the fact that it forms a virtual constellation. It also is capable of driving some of the modeling products that you may know already from the CFS or from other sources. The tier one products are just the core stuff that normally comes with a satellite. Normally, when you see, you know, MODIS or VIIRS or whatever, it's just tier one. That's all they really are core sort of fire products. Tier two is the synthesis with VIIRS. This is the point where we get into the ability to really capitalize on that virtual constellation. And it's the stuff that starts tilting towards fire behavior, rate, direction of spread, things like that. Tier three is now that we have a reliable operational sort of assessment of fires on a routine, we can start to just automate the driving of fire growth models, the driving of other sort of not WildFireSat specific products, but things that you may be familiar with inside of CWFIS and whatnot. And then beyond that, there's also some other products. We, in consultation with the provinces early on, it was flagged to us that Some people saw this as a very useful for doing monitoring of remote fires. But if they got to the end of the day and it was super cloudy and they didn't have any wildfires, that data, then, well, guess what? Tomorrow we're going to fly it no matter what. And so we in that discussion kind of came up with the solution of, well, at noon, we can probably provide you guys with a cloud forecast for 1800 for all of your active fires. And then you would have the tool to make the decision on that day. You know, is it an 80% chance you get wildfires at? Is it a 5% chance? And at least empower people to make responsible decisions there. So quickly on the ConOps, I did mention that the satellite is not one satellite. It is a constellation, as we say. Again, this is all about trying to get cleaner and more qualified data. This is a visualization of the orbit from the Phase A work. It may almost certainly not be the exact same configuration when we go through Phase B, but as it stands, this is what you can expect, is three satellites that are in a convoy, and because the Earth is turning underneath them, when they hit the ground, their swaths overpasses just slightly align, and it gives you the impression that you're looking at data from a single satellite, but in reality, it's just a little, it's like the three amigos are having a little party up there. I have been talking about, you know, this is a Canadian mission. The mission will have the capacity to cover the whole Earth. Well, it will cover the whole Earth. There is, at this point in time, we only have the downlinking capability over Canada. And so there is an awful lot of ongoing work, primarily on my plate at the moment, to try and refine the international approach, the international policy associated with this. One note of interest here, this is averaged over average revisit period over an entire year. And you'll notice that the bulk of Canada, it says 12 to 18 hours. And I just told you it was going to be 12 hours. Well, the reality is that just along the border with the US, you will find little tiny triangles that get missed. Those triangles will move every single day. They're never in the same spot. So let's say you are, sorry, Fort Francis, but say you're Fort Francis, you're right down on the border. You may miss wildfires at once a week or something like that. That's the kind of scope of misses we're talking about. But when you average it over a full year, you can't say that it's 12 hours. This binning is probably unfair. It's probably would average out to like 13 hours or something. But that's an incredibly complicated diagram, and I'm not going to walk through the whole thing. But if you'd like to read the concept of operations, give me a call or send me an email and we can send it to you. Suffice to say, you have to have a pretty complex dance card that is set up that coordinates, you know, the commanding and control of the satellite, the downlinking of the data, the onboard processing, the on-ground processing, the trafficking of it through the pipelines, where the products are generated, where the products are archived, and how it all traffics in and out. Where is it that we can have knobs and dials to go in and do airborne campaigns and fix the satellite and get it into a better operating stance? Or can we upgrade things? It all has to be considered. One of our co-leads of the mission, Alan Canton, is the champion of this, and I bow before his diligence because this stuff overwhelms me. What is important is the SOC. It's kind of like center lower right. I don't know. SOC, that's the Science Operations Center. And that's basically where we are executing the processing. And it also includes where we are trafficking the data through. And that is a mixture of EODMS from CCMEO and CWFIF. We aren't going to reinvent the wheel on information systems inside of this. If you're familiar with the CWFAF, then you know what I'm talking about. If you're not, you may be familiar with the good old CWFIS. This will be our primary portal to move things through. That doesn't necessarily mean that everyone will access it exclusively through the website. We will have the ability to push products directly to individual provinces or territories who, if that is the need that you have, but you'll also have the ability to use this system if you want to access it easily. A few words about knowledge exchange. This is a pointless effort if it doesn't get used. And that's just the long and short of it. The mission is something that, you know, CFS is well aligned to be the people to champion this and lead it. But ultimately, the use case comes from a lot of people who are likely on this call today. So we have put a tremendous amount of emphasis on this inside of the downstream aspect of the mission. Of the new funding that we got, it's probably in the order of 30 to 40% of the investment on the downstream is actually targeted towards the knowledge exchange program. If you aren't aware of who in your agency is the representative to that group, I'm sure that folks will be able to help you out with that, or we can get you in touch. Email Colin McVaden. You see his name at the bottom of the slide. That would be ideal. But he's the lead for it. And ultimately, you know, I think it's important that people understand that when we talk about knowledge exchange in the context of this program, it's not knowledge transfer. It's not communications. It is back and forth, real exchange. We need to understand how you're going to use the products in order to make sure that they are tailored to your purposes. I can't change the science. I can't change physics. I've thought about it, but I can't. The truth is that we can generate what we can generate, but how we package it, how we deliver it, how we educate on it, and how we distribute things can be influenced in a lot of different ways. And those things can be done to assist the uptake and to meet more specific needs, then by all means, we're going to do it. And there is a very real commitment to this. I think a lot of you may have already been involved in some of the readiness studies that were kicked off earlier this year. I believe that the anonymized version of that report has been accepted for publication. And I think every agency also received an internal report that tailored to their own readiness level. And this is an assessment of how prepared, not necessarily like a critique in any way, but it's just a way of identifying, you know, we've got a few years before launch. How is it that you can prioritize your investments to prepare for this or something like it? I've been a long-standing advocate that bad things happen. All right, we could get down to the end here, and this thing could blow up on the launch pad. And if it does, do me a solid and don't talk to me for a day or two. But the truth is that if we get to that point and we have succeeded in everything we've done up to this point, then our country will be more prepared to utilize Earth observation and fire management than any other country in the world. And that means that if wildfires that blew up, so be it. The hard part is done and something will come right behind us. So this is our safety net in some ways as well. Next steps. I would probably simplify next steps and just say everything. You know, the science is quite mature, but it needs to be refined for these explicit applications. We know how to do it, but no one's done it. So it's time to implement a lot of things. There is some industrial contracting going on to start building towards phase B. I was hoping to be able to announce who those contracts would be today, but we're just in a bit of a holding pattern, but it should be by the end of the week. You know what? I never say a timeline. I'll just eat my words on it. The international policy is a big priority. We do need to understand where it lies for external to the country. Alan's bullet is that next one about data product development, continue agency engagement, IMIT readiness, all those things. There's an awful lot that needs to be done on that side, and it is actively being pursued. And the knowledge exchange stuff, anyone who knows Colin knows that is on a rail, and you, good luck stopping them. All that to say, we're targeting launch in the winter 28-29, operational in the 29 fire season. The build is for a five-year operational life. Normally, when you do something like this, the length of your guaranteed operational life is what drives the cost. But to put it in perspective for you, we are currently deorbiting with MODIS. It was launched in 2001 or 2002 with a five-year life. So, you know, when you guarantee something will survive for 5 years, very often it will survive for 10 or 15 or 20, and we'll have the ability to expand the program and keep it operating past that. Should we be in that happy mistake? So our tier leads and the mission management team here, and I'm happy to take any questions from folks. If I can find my screen.
Josh, I don't have anything in the chat yet.
Beauty. Looks like quite a lot of folks.
Yeah, so if anyone does have a question, feel free to type it into the chat, and then I think Heather will be able to let you unmute your mic to speak if you want to speak, or you can just ask your question in the chat.
Well, people are sitting here thinking,
yes,
I have a thing about the detection. Now, I think we've had this conversation before, but maybe if you can expand on this of why, yes. I think I've got a good understanding of why. And you know, like some of it is just data processing time and you know, like the lag in detection. There's big promises being made by some people on geostationary satellites and how they're going to solve problems. And
yeah, so you should totally enjoy my talk at FP's detection workshop next week. Just in general, when it comes to satellites, and there's a fundamental difference here. If you are doing traditional detection, you are looking for smoke, usually, right? A lot of the time, even with airborne detection, you're looking for little smokes coming up. Little smokes coming up through the canopy typically are from very small fires, might be getting a little bit of ventilation in there, but they tend to be smoldering sub-canopy fires. If you are doing detection from a satellite, you are looking for a heat signature from a fire. And so typically when people start to quote you a detectable fire area from something like from MODIS, it's very conventional to say it's about 100 meters squared is the detectable fire area. It's true for a flaming fire without a canopy over top of it. And that's a very, very potent heat signature. But a smoldering fire is a much, much lower heat signature. And then when you put it underneath a forest canopy, and the boreal forest is so dense in canopy closure, it has to be very big. Basically for MODIS, sorry, for Sentinel 3, which is kind of the replacement for MODIS, you're talking about needing a smoldering fire anywhere around 0.5 hectares before it could possibly be visible, sub-canopy. VIRS, you can do a little bit better, maybe 0.3 hectares. But the truth of the matter is that in order for it to have that much area of smoldering, I'm not talking about that much area where half of it's smoldering, half of it's dead burn. The whole thing has to be one massive heat signature. It's a losing battle. Until there is canopy involvement, and then until you have flame, open flame that is connecting above the canopy, you're going to have a really hard time finding it with a satellite. Geostationaries are far worse, by the way, far, far, far worse up here. And I know that people believe AI can push you beyond these things, but there is also a physical reality. You have to push the midwave spectral signature above the background, and that's not possible unless you have enough heat. Now, beyond that, there's other ways you can promise it with satellites. There's a lot of people very interested in potassium emissions from flames. That's exclusively from flame, right? So you can't even find a smoldering fire with potassium. You need to have open flame. So basically, you have to have torching before you can find it with that, or open fire in a field. And no matter which one you're using, you're always going to have clouds that block you out. So I know that a lot of the time people think that the easiest business case is detection. Sure, maybe it is, but it's probably the easiest way to disappoint people as well. But if you build it as a surveillance system, a monitoring system, and it just has the fringe benefit that in remote areas it also finds you new fires for you, then that's a happy accident.
Thanks for that. And in the chat, we've got Michael Flanagan saying, have you connected with folks in Alaska as they would obviously be interested in this effort?
Yes, Mike, absolutely. They've been offering their ground stations in Fairbanks so preemptively and enthusiastically, it's actually quite shocking. But yes, no, we are in touch with them. You know, when I say the international policy needs to be addressed in a lot of ways, we have built in the capacity to cover North America. So I think one way or another, Alaska and the U.S., I mean, they're implicitly our partners because we're forming a constellation with them. But at the bare minimum, yes, they will be covered. Actually, even if we downlink from Canadian stations, we will inadvertently cover Alaska. Just from the footprint.
Okay. Oh, and then
also, hi, Mike.
I've got a number of questions for you. So, you know, if nobody else wants to have questions, I'll just keep going. But one thing is, so we know that VIRS, that MODIS is coming down. And I don't think it's that long until it is down. So you're meant to be working with VIRS. Do you know the timeline for VIRS?
So first off, MODIS, I think we won in the battle to keep it turned on as it deorbits, by the way, but it'll become useless for you very quickly, but it'll be fascinating for nerds. The VIRS one, so VIRS is a little bit different. They've been positioned to NOAA, and the JPSS satellites are kind of keeping a continuity level there. That should be an operational system in that sense. Like, there will be continuity in the VIRS missions. So you can't really predict when the current ones up there are gonna call it quits. But everything I've heard thus far, and we will be directly engaging at more senior levels in NOAA soon, there should be continuity where VIRS will at least overlap with us, if not exceed us.
Awesome. And then another question in the chat, what about other countries other than Alaska? Of course, Alaska
is a
country.
It's complicated. It is complicated in I don't want to get too deep into it at the moment. There's been some very public messaging all through phase A and everything up till now. You know, the messaging has always been the system should have the capability to cover the whole Earth. In phase A, we found it would be power positive. There would be no issue to operate it over the full orbit. And so the question was always, well, then other countries, all they need to do is provide their own downlinking, and we have an agreement, and we try and coordinate with their ground stations. I don't believe that has changed, but at the same time, there is some questions at the moment about, yes, it'll be power positive, but will that wear and tear of operating the black body continuously, could that shorten the lifespan? If you look at how things are designed in it, I don't believe that's going to be the case. But I would be hesitant to make any 100% guarantees on the international side until we have like a proper policy in place. And rest assured, considering I'm the guy who has to sit on all the international committees that relate to Earth observation of fire, I have a very high priority of making sure it's available elsewhere, because I'm going to hear about it if it ain't.
Awesome. And then when MODIS finally deorbits, is Canada planning another satellite to maintain the constellation?
Nope. No, MODIS, interesting fact, MODIS already has its replacement up there. So under the Copernicus program, Sentinel 3, it has the SLSTR instrument, which is heritage from ATSR. And it produces fire products. It actually has dedicated fire channels on that instrument. That will be the continuity for the 10 a.m. overpass. Actually, if you're not aware, over the last several years, my old PhD supervisor, Martin Worcester, is the PI of the Sentinel 3 products. And we've been doing calibration and validation of them in the Red Lake area for the last few years, and should be doing it again this summer. So that's your replacement for MODIS. It'll come from a different source. There may very well be some sort of centralizing of those products in the near future. I'll leave it at that. And then VIRS replaces the Aqua overpass of MODIS, replaces and exceeds that way.
Give other people an opportunity, but I still have more questions.
You're welcome to ask questions. I want to see some. I want to give a quick shout out to, I know that there is the youngest fire scientist in the world on this call right now. So have at her, Girardi. Happy day, buddy. There he is. Sometimes a sick day is okay for a kid, you know, he gets to. Okay. Anyhow, go ahead, Heather, if you got questions.
So the agency readiness, mm-hmm. I did put the paper link in the chat, and now I'm going to do a nasty thing to you and say, can you give us a plain language summary about agency readiness and what you're really looking for from agencies in anticipation of wildfire sat?
Wow. So this is, and I don't say this often, but that's an excellent question for Colin. I'm somewhat hands-off on that study, to be honest with you. But I can tell you at a high level, what they're looking for, what they're trying to assess is, where are the potential barriers to getting these things into meaningful operations? Is it people? Is it preconceptions? Is it IMIT? Is it, things of those sorts of assessments? I don't believe that I'm really equipped to simplify it further than that, to be honest with you. Matt might actually have a better idea than I do on that study.
Yeah, that's essentially it. It's trying to work with each of the agencies to identify where they see their own weaknesses or areas in which they could most take the opportunity of improving while the technology is developing, so that they're ready to hit the ground running once data is being offered to agencies.
And you know, ultimately, we're using MODIS like a household name in this discussion, which is kind of weird, right? If it became operational in 2002, I can't remember if that's Aqua or Terra, whatever. It really wasn't something that was ever being meaningfully used in operations for over a decade after that. And even then, it's done very scarcely. That's what happens when you build a general purpose satellite and you figure out all these cool things you can do with it. And then all of a sudden, you know, over time, there's just this gradual acceleration. We already know what we want to do with this. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're benefiting from day one. And that's why you're seeing all this push to prepare ourselves for this, because we don't want people, you know, waking up in 2029 going, oh, this is super cool. Now I'm going to put in a ticket to upgrade my IT system that's going to take me 3 years. That would be unfortunate.
All right. More questions I've got. So I used satellite data during my research, and my last year of firefighting, I can quote somebody who was in operations talking about the challenges that we were having with multiple fires. You know, we had multiple large fires breaking out at the same time, a big fire flap, and there was an expletive in it, but it was also, I am currently setting evacuation notices by MODIS, from MODIS. Oh, no. So that was the level of fire activity that we had going. You know, it was just an absolute incredible fire flap. We had, you know, multiple type one, type two fires just blowing up all over the place. And somebody was going, I'm starting to think about evacuations using MODIS data. And this was back in 2010. So that's an actual use case of, you know, satellite data that was not designed for that. And that's the level that of operational need when there's like these massive, you know, multiple fires coming out and stuff like that. And then I was using MODIS and FIERS data and looking at, you know, other things during my PhD to monitor where fires are active and where they're not active, and doing that, the fire footprints and mapping and all of these kind of things. And you've given us some idea of, you know, the ability that you're expecting to come out of that, the improvements that you're expecting to come out of that. And I can see that it's going to be definitely going to be better. So my question is, there's operational need on even just like, you know, being able to track fires more effectively, where they are, how far they're moving, how many you have. That was one of the challenges for us, is that we actually got to the point where we had so many fires in one day that we had a hard time even knowing how many fires we had on the landscape.
Yeah.
Go ahead and talk about
that. Oh, no, I've got so much to say to that. You know, it's terrifying to think of using MODIS in that way. But I know a story of one of my old friends from the crew system got sent down. I think he was in Utah or something. And he encountered, like, this crew was going out, a hotshot crew was going out to the line, and they were flying out based on a perimeter they've been given, and he was looking at it going, that is an ugly perimeter. And it was a MODIS perimeter. And they were like mobilizing resources on a massive fire based on that. And that's horrifying, right? And so, but that said, yes, there will be dramatic changes. There will be, you know, those are the scenarios where I think WildFireSat will come into its own. When you're overrun, when you've got too much fire on the landscape, or you don't have the ability to fly for a while because you're smoked in, you know, or if you've got a whole bunch of IA going on in the south, and in the north you got a whole bunch of monitored fires, well, you can keep tabs on all of them, right? You could start to free up resources who might otherwise be diverted to do that recon and prioritize them to somewhere else. The intention there, with this level of information improvement, you should be able to basically imagine a fire arrival time or almost like a day of burn type thing. But imagine that being refined to a point where it's so clear that you could actually start to call it rate of spread in certain situations. And that's the kind of information we're trying to give, because no, I still don't think you should take WildFireSat data and on its own, you know, to order an evacuation. But, you know, it's different still than doing it on MODIS, because MODIS is a discrete glimpse at a point in time. Most of the time, people getting it don't even really know when that capture happened. The way we're organizing this is every fire becomes an individual event, and that fire gets tracked by WildFireSat through time. And because it's an event-based system, you know, when you get information from WildFireSat, unless it's a new detection, you will also have the whole history of that fire attached to it as well. And so, you know, is there a chance that people will end up using it for evacuations? My goodness, yes, it is possible, but not in a blind sense. What I'd like to see more is to centralize so much information about the history of that fire, and make it so accessible that you have enough situational awareness on it from day to day that you can comfortably say, well, if tomorrow it hits these markers, then we're probably in a position to have some form of response. And that, I think that, you know, when you start to parse that sort of information in such a way, it's also going to include all the smoke products attached to it too, right? So we're just trying to give people more information at their fingertips for when they need it. You can't see this for everyone all the time, but it's the scenario where, you know, you get to the end of the day and you're trying to figure out if you even have any more jet fuel for your helicopters tomorrow, and somebody asks you, so what about those fires that are up by the flying communities? And you can pull it up quickly and you can just see what all of them have done in that afternoon. Were there any surprises or not? That's more the way I'm hoping that it would be used, as a way of not being a last resort thing, but as a way of routinely maintaining enough awareness that you can confidently make decisions over time.
Well, I have one last question.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Australia for the 2019-2020 fire year, and we were smoked out a lot. So is it smoke penetrating?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of people seem to, it's always entertaining when vendors try and really push their type of IR is going to see through smoke. It sees through smoke. The midwave and longwave will cut through smoke. Midwave cuts through it far better. Once you start to introduce water vapor into that, so like, and I mean large quantities of water vapor. So if you got a huge flame front and behind it, you know, that white plume that trails up from behind, it will have trouble penetrating the white plume. Now, but yes, if it's just smoke, if you're smoked in, it's not an issue at all. One of the things we are doing differently with this is we are also going to be including, normally a satellite gives you a cloud product. You know, it could be a thick cloud, thin cloud, or whatever, and it's a mask that goes on. We'll also be discriminating smoke contaminated cloud out of that. And so the reason for that is that instead of just showing a cloud that covers off the middle of your fire, we should be able to identify that this is a smoke plume coming out of your fire, because that layer provides you more information. It's not that the fire was out on that side. It's that the fire was cooking over there and we couldn't see through it. But yeah, other than that, other than white smoke, that thick white smoke that is basically just smoldering combustion, you will be able to see through the type of smoke that stalks you in when you're just sitting there and the sunrise is abnormally orange or the noon is abnormally orange. Yeah, it won't have a problem seeing through that.
Awesome. Well, Matt, I don't know if you have anything further.
Not seeing any other questions in the chat. I guess the one thing you mentioned that was news to me that I find pretty exciting is the collaboration with VIIRS and the ability to do change detection in between overpasses. I think that could have a lot of real implications for fire management.
Yeah, that's where all the fire behavior stuff comes from, right? Well, not all of it. The fire intensity we can extract from the radiometry, but the direction and rate of spread is something that can be derived from that. There's a caveat to that. Yeah, I would call it progression until the fire is moving about probably 15 meters a minute, and at which point we could switch it and call it rate of spread. You know, just it's uncertainties, and we're going to be annoyingly transparent about that uncertainty. I apologize in advance for that.
We had somebody pop a hand up for a second.
Yeah, it looked like Derek Gilby.
Yeah, sorry, trigger happy there. Had to click my mic a couple times. I can see, I guess going back to your comment there about evacuations based on satellite imagery. I don't think it would happen here, but I think in certain conditions, we would use it in our duty room in a data feed, because we are pretty much close to a wildfire interface no matter where you go. And I can see this helping us a lot. Last year, we had our third largest fire, I think since 1976. It's like 3,200 hectares. And we're just glad it was in a part of, the trees and not around the coast, but it grew and grew and it grew fast. And I know that would help us in determining, fire size and rate of growth and stuff. But I mean, ours isn't, we don't monitor, we action everything. And our public is right on, the detection. But I think for us, a data feed with, in a wildfire, wildland urban interface is our biggest concern. So if we could see it, in the duty room in the middle of the province, we'd have a good idea of what's going on instead of just relying on people and stuff in the field. So not to say that we wouldn't use it for evacuations, but you never know if it's getting close in the right spot. Maybe, because we can, we can drive from one end of Nova Scotia to the next in 10 hours. So, I mean, we're not very big. So any sort of help like that, detections would be great. Or feeds. Yeah.
And that's really interesting feedback, Derek. I appreciate that. I always am shocked by I can't remember what it is. It's like nearly 60 or 70% of your landmass would be classed as urban interface.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's there's a lot.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room to mess around. Holy.
Yeah, I think there's only a couple spots in the Highlands and down the west that, you know, doesn't have roads. So, but I mean, yeah, it can turn that fast. It in 2 days it went to 31 hectares, which is unheard of here. So I mean, our weather patterns, and if it was closer to a community, would have been bad news. But we're looking forward to using the data feeds and stuff like that. So,
right on.
Different reasons, I guess. Thank you.
That's super cool, though, and that's really the driver behind that knowledge exchange group, is to, like, I can stand here as a scientist and tell you what I think it should be used for. That's kind of meaningless. I can tell you what it can do, and it's better for you folks to tell us how you can use that, and then we can start to tailor it in a direction to make it more accessible for those things.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Josh, thank you very much for presenting. It's the top of the hour again, so I think we're finished.